Good morning or afternoon, everyone, and welcome to emforum.org for today's special event, the second in a series on FEMA initiatives. I am Amy Sebring and will serve as your moderator today, and we are very glad you could join us. We've had a special request for those of you who tweet. You may use the hashtag EMForum if you wish to tweet along with us. Now, before we begin with today's topic, I would like to provide a quick update on our last program about the Strategic Foresight Initiative. Topic categories related to SFI are now available on the FEMA IdeaScale Collaborative Community website at fema.ideascale.com, where you can now provide your feedback. Today's program is focused on FEMA's Whole Community Initiative. A new report, A Whole Community Approach to Emergency Management, Principles, Themes, and Pathways for Action, was recently published to synthesize the findings of a national dialogue that FEMA has been leading over the past year. We expect many of you are familiar, at least in a general way, with the concept, but today is an opportunity to learn more, ask questions, and provide your feedback directly. We will begin with an overview presentation and then proceed to your question and comments. Now, for a little housekeeping, if you have difficulty with live meeting, you may use the feedback drop-down menu at the top right to indicate that you're having a problem, and then my associates, Ava Jean Moore or Lori Weber, will monitor that and try to provide you with assistance via instant messaging. We will provide further instructions just before we begin the Q&A, but we ask you basically to hold your questions and comments till we get to that part of the program. We are making a recording today, which will be posted later this afternoon, along with a copy of the slides. And if you're not on our mailing list, you can subscribe from our homepage, and you will get a notice of when these materials are available, as well as future program invitations. We will also have a summary transcript early next week. Now, once again, it is my pleasure to introduce today's special guest. David Kaufman has been the director of FEMA's Office of Policy and Program Analysis since his appointment during September 2009. And in this position, he is responsible for providing leadership, analysis, coordination, and decision-making support to the FEMA administrator on a wide range of agency policies, plans, programs, and key initiatives. Now, please do see today's background page for additional biographical detail and links to the Whole Community Initiative website and report. Welcome back, David, and thank you very much for joining us today. I now turn the floor over to you to start us off, please.
Thank you, Amy. Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you all for taking time out of your days to engage in this conversation with us. I want to stress a couple of points just at the onset of all of this. The first is that we do view this as an evolving and continuing conversation. This is a discussion that we are having collectively as a field of practice about how we approach doing our business, not so much about the technical functions that we execute, but the mental frame that we bring to how we execute those functions. And so in many respects, this is absolutely a conversation about philosophy, about paradigm and ideology, not in a political sense, but in a applied sense in the context of how we provide the best possible emergency management outcomes for communities and survivors. So I'm going to try to thread in the very beginning of this discussion a few things together for you, starting with sort of a very, very brief recap of some of the top-level findings out of our Foresight Initiative. I will keep that very brief for folks that participated in that last conversation, but I think it's equally important to think about the discussions around Whole Community in the context of the challenges we face today and tomorrow. And we view this very much as a value proposition, as an approach that has merit now and in the future and is responsible to some of those longer-term needs. So I think it's important to set that up. And then I want to move into sort of the linkages back to the current policy emphasis on a national scale, some of the major direction from the president in this area and such, and some of the other initiatives that you're probably aware of or activity streams that are going on and how these concepts interrelate, and then kind of walk through the content itself with you. The last point that I would make by way of starting this is nothing in here is stuff that a few of us went and sat in a room and came up with. This is very much a synthesis and reflection back of what I would characterize as already emerging and leading edge practice within the field at many different levels. And I'll try briefly to give you a few stories and examples as we go through the conversation of some of the things that we've learned and where we've seen or derived some of these insights from. And there's a lot more in the published content that we have available, our report, A Whole Community Approach to Emergency Management, which is available from our website. It's easy to find. So with that as sort of an opening remark, let me just step back and revisit the broader picture for a moment. So as many of you are aware, we have a companion initiative that is looking at the implications of a changing world for the practice of emergency management. And in a nutshell, this is sort of the context that we're seeing over the coming decades. Increasing empowerment of individuals, very much technology-enabled, but not solely a function of that. Radical changes already and continuing in the way information and knowledge move, and the influence nodes and where people turn to for that influence or for information in all sorts of contexts, whether on a daily basis or in times of crisis. Certainly impossible to predict changes in the context of the security environment technologically, what happens with respect to terrorist threat streams and targeting efforts, et cetera. Dramatic demographic shifts, both worldwide and within the United States. You know, for the first time in human history, more people live in urban centers around the world than not, and that trend is just intensifying. Simultaneous trends between aging populations in developed worlds and greater linguistic diversity in our country, all sorts of issues wrapped up in that. Changes in both the man-made and the natural environments, the state of U.S. infrastructure, the capital investment required to shore up that infrastructure over time, and the implications of that, as well as the shifts that we are already seeing manifest in the world's climate and what those mean for the practice of emergency management. And then rolling that all together, sort of this sense that that events can jump or cascade much more rapidly and much more broadly than past experience might leave us with an understanding of. So as we think about that in the context of what it means for emergency management, these are the kinds of things that emerged out of that work as being particularly important. Coming to terms with both increasing complexity and decreasing predictability. Thinking differently about how we assess and understand risk, with an eye to looking forward, being dynamic and anticipatory, not necessarily relying on historical experience over time as being indicative of future context. Grappling with challenges that are not just in the context of acute events, but also chronic issues over time. So drought is a good example of that in an emergency management context, but this is also an across-the-board issue as we think about shifts in the stressors that are at work in our communities in many different contexts. We see real changes in the means and methods for how emergency services are delivered in times of crisis, and greater role being played by the private sector and by the public, you know, community-based organizations, nonprofits, et cetera, over time. And so a lot of opportunity here, because we see those trends emerging regardless of what we in government do. And then the real question is, how does that work? So to put a finer point on that, are communities organizing themselves in cooperation with local authorities or in opposition to local authorities? And I think we have plenty of experience of both when we look at disasters in our own country, all of which reinforces this last point about trust and the critical importance of strengthening it. So that's sort of the 20,000-foot view. As we think more about the here and now, and reflect on what the national policy framework is with respect to this mission space, a tremendous emphasis on resilience. And in particular, when you look at the language in the National Security Strategy, in the Quadrennial Homeland Security Review, in Presidential Directive 8, the National Preparedness Goal, the recently released National Disaster Recovery Framework, in all of these places, we are seeing real emphasis on empowerment of individuals, of families, of communities, on the ideas of local leadership and local primacy, of broad-based inclusiveness, and of engagement. And in some respects, that language isn't new, and in other respects, there are different nuances to how it's being used and the degree of importance that I think is being placed on some of those issues. And so as we sort of entered into this conversation, this is the context within which we've been approaching it. I think it's worth sort of reflecting for a moment and stepping outside all of that that I just went through and thinking about what emergency management, what disaster management is really fundamentally about. And it's about people. It's about helping people and helping collections of people, communities, move through difficult times in as best a way as possible. And there are some simple realities about how that works in the world that serve as good foundation points to come back to and really have helped frame for us our thinking around whole community. So the first of these is the acknowledgement of the role that the public already plays on an everyday basis. And this is not to diminish the role that any of the professional services play. It's just a recognition of what already occurs, that more often than not, the first people on scene are neighbors helping neighbors. They're bystanders helping each other. They're members of the public reacting to what has just occurred, whatever it is, and offering initial medical care, requests for assistance, all sorts of activities. This is really important when you listen to Administrator Fugate talk. This is part of the foundation for his language about thinking about survivors and then thinking about the role that survivors can play and need to be allowed to play in meeting their needs and the needs of others in times of crisis. The second point is really something interesting. Obviously, the last few years, we have devoted considerable attention to issues around recovery and improving our approach to supporting recovery within this country. And, just sort of a candid reflection that in the cases where we can point to that communities have really successfully recovered or really on a strong path, it's almost always the case that that direction is driven from within. That's an organic process. It's not an outsider's view of what recovery should look like in that community, nor is it a single sector's view. It's not just the business interest's view of recovery in that community, or just government's view, or just faith's view. It's a melding of all of those. It's messy. It's difficult. It's time-consuming. It's civic engagement in a very real sense, but it's organic. It's from within. And so understanding that means, and thinking about how we support that means understanding what are the roots of that success, where does that lie, and how can we support and nurture those roots. And so this flows nicely into the third point that's up here, which is just a simple recognition that while the language we use is most often bureaucratic language, it's the language of how government organizes and manages itself, emergency management is inherently a social process. And this is an observation from a fire chief in the D.C. area locally that I think is really important framing for this conversation. And then the last point that I want to kind of leave you with and kind of concluding the setup for getting into the meat, we often think about the emergency management cycle in the context of the different missions, the different responsibilities that we execute, protection, mitigation, preparedness, response, recovery, et cetera. And the graphics we use depict those in a circular fashion for the most part. And they're all usually oriented around a point in time at which a disaster occurs. And that can create blinders that are inadvertent because the focus of that framing is almost entirely around the impacts of the disaster. And what I want to submit to you in thinking about is that the disaster itself is just one variable in what produces those impacts. We're pretty comfortable thinking about it that way in the context of mitigation missions. And so thinking about how we reduce risk through altering the built environment, whether that's building code initiatives or levees or, you know, better floodplain management, et cetera, we're thinking about the physical environment and the way that the disaster interacts with the physical environment to produce the effects. That's still only part of the picture. And the real focus of what we're going to talk about is how the social environment works in that same way, how pre-existing social conditions in communities interact with the disaster and are affected by the disaster and continue to exist in modified form on the back end. So this is all about how issues of equality and health and access, all of those kinds of things feed into the challenges that we experience operationally in the context of response and of recovery, et cetera, and how communities' fabric is altered by those experiences. So that's all sort of the content swirling in the ether around us as we began to acknowledge that we needed to open a larger conversation about these issues. And so over the past year and a half, we have made a concerted effort to launch that national conversation. We've held dozens of different sessions at everything from national conferences, NEMA, IEM, et cetera, to community meetings and given in certain communities around the country and talked with members of the public about their experiences in the context of their local communities with respect to these issues. And the product of all of that has been astonishing. First, phenomenal innovation that's already happening all across this country in new and creative ways to deal with some of these challenges and to deliver better outcomes to people in need at the moments where that need is greatest. And so I'll walk through a lot of that with you as well. I think that it's also important to mention here that our exploration is really inspired in part by work that's gone on in the past in other fields. So what we're describing and thinking about as we look at whole community as a framework for an approach for the practice of emergency management is very much analogous to the rise of community-oriented policing as an approach to law enforcement or the framing that we use in public health. For example, the Institute of Medicine defines public health as what we as a society do collectively to assure the conditions for people to be healthy. And so that emphasis on societal, not just on government, which so strongly and directly mirrors the language in presidential direction, the National Security Strategy and PPD8, as well as on, you know, not just addressing the symptoms or curing the sick, but on setting the conditions that allow for people to be healthy. And so that bring that back and think about how do we set the conditions that allow for optimal response and recovery in affected communities in times of crisis and optimal prevention and protection in advance of. So we have synthesized everything that I'm going through and will go through in a doctrinal piece, which we hope is accessible and easy to read. It's not long, about 20, 25 pages. It's told mostly through story and anecdote, and it's available on our website. You see it on the right-hand side of the screen. And that's really been our effort to distill everything we've learned through these dozens of engagements and conversations that we've participated in with all of you and your colleagues around the country, and then reflect that back so that we begin to create a body of knowledge together that we can all use to move forward. The end of that document seeks to help start us in moving from understanding the concepts to steps we can take to apply those concepts in our own communities and our own organizations, hence the end of the title, Pathways for Action. So what I want to do very briefly is just kind of walk through what the core principles are that have emerged from all of this exploration and give you some simple phrases and examples to use to put meaning behind those principles. And then open it up for discussion with all of you, because we by no means view this as a finished conversation, just a first milestone in that discussion. We have a tremendous way to go to continue to learn about how we do this well, what works, what doesn't work, why it works and doesn't work in different contexts, and how we can continue to evolve. But stepping back and thinking about what does it mean to say whole community in the context of emergency management. And so this is really what it boils down to. It means understanding and meeting the actual needs of the entire community, and in particular when it's really bad. So I think all too often we find or stumble across faulty assumptions in our planning processes about what people's needs will be or what the best ways are to meet those needs. And I'll pick on a couple of them that you've heard the administrator or myself or others reference in past discussions. So one of them is what the default or one of the traditional default ways is for thinking about how you feed people in crisis. And it's shipping MREs, meals ready to eat. And that makes perfect sense from the standpoint of a certain understanding of the problem and from a standpoint of what's easy to drive that solution with. You know, MREs exist. They're in stockpiles already. It's easy to preserve them and to procure them, and they offer a lot of advantages in that way. But as many of you may have heard Craig reference, you know, his grandkids can't eat an MRE. My children can't eat an MRE. Neither can my grandmother. And so for all the value that they offer, they're still only a partial solution. And so this approach is absolutely about understanding what's the full spectrum of need that's going to exist, and then how is that need being met yesterday? And sticking with the feeding people example. Who was feeding people in the affected communities before the disaster? It wasn't government. For the most part, government only feeds people in schools and prisons, and we contract almost all of that out anyway. So it's the private sector, but it was also the faith-based sector, nonprofit organizations, food banks, Meals on Wheels, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's whole networks of mechanisms by which people are fed in this country. Some the ones that we're more used to thinking about, and others we're maybe less used to thinking about. And they're different place to place. What constitutes those networks in different communities shifts. So it's not a single answer. But that's really about what those first two points speak to. So if you understand what the full spectrum need is that needs to be delivered, food from newborn all the way to the other extreme, and what comes along with that, right, because what goes in comes out. So that means diapers of every size. And I have young kids, and I'm still astonished at how many different kinds of diapers we have in our house. But leaving that issue aside, because I know none of you care, the larger point being who's involved and how can we involve them in better understanding the need and in delivering that solution. So this is equally about how do we reconstitute the mechanisms that were working yesterday while we're supplementing them. And that drives us right into that third point about understanding what is working well in communities on an everyday basis. Where are the places people are turning already for to organize social activity, to solve problems, to debate issues, for social support? And starting there, those are the entry points, the things that people are already turning to. Those are where we can begin to cast the broader net and think about who's part of the team in a way that allows us to mobilize all available resources, all available capabilities, regardless of sector, to deliver needs in the affected area. So I'll walk through each of these principles and give you a couple of subpoints on them, and then bring it to a close and open this up for discussion. With respect to the first one, a few sort of taglines or phrases that emerged in the discussion that we felt really captured the heart of this nicely. The first is understand community DNA. Communities are very complex, and each of us participates in many different communities in our lives, some professional, some personal, some family, some faith, et cetera, some locational-based, some virtual. So this is no simple undertaking, and hence the reference to DNA, because it really can be incredibly complex to understand how social activities organized and needs are being met in communities on an everyday basis. The upside to that is there are people who study that for a living in all of our communities, in universities and in other settings, and in government agencies that have other missions, et cetera. So there's partnership opportunity here. This isn't entirely about what skills that we need to build internally just within the field of emergency management. The second part is something I already emphasized, but that planning for what the real demand will actually be, not the part that we're used to planning for or not just the capabilities that we have. And that last point is really important. On the one hand, it's inherently logical to say if I have 10 of whatever teams or units of something of capability in some fashion, why would I write a plan that calls for 15 if I only have 10? And you understand why we get to a place where we plan for what we have to use. But the flip side of that is when the problem space exceeds the capabilities that we have, we haven't worked through who else to engage or how to cope in that context. And so it's important to understand what the real demand is likely to be, and not on an everyday basis, but when it's severe. And then use that understanding to inform who we engage to be part of that conversation. And so that's that third point. Understand and recognize, acknowledge the capabilities that already exist within our communities and where people are already turning to. So I'm going to give you the first half of an example to drive home some of the points under this principle, and I'll give you the second half in a minute. So there's a very low-income border community, very ethnically mixed, outside of San Diego. And when the fires a couple of years ago were coming up over the ridge at that community turned to what is one of the social hubs of that community. It's the civic center, the community center. And that's where they went for help. That's where they went to say, what do we do? And the problem was that community center was not connected to any of the official apparatus in the context that we're all used to thinking about emergency management. And so no one knew. So there was a disconnect, a misalignment between where the public was turning for support in the moment of the crisis and what the official mechanisms were arrayed to connect with. So there's a positive ending to this, which I'll give you in a minute, but let me first sort of scope, you know, the second part of this, which is it's all well and good to acknowledge the need to understand, but that means then we have to talk to. We have to bring in those voices that may not traditionally have been part of the conversation or have been underrepresented, and we have to really meet people where they are. And I like that framing for this a lot because it really is that simple, and I'll use some of our messaging as an example. We very often have a tendency to put out information, but we're not always cognizant of the fact, or as cognizant as we can be of the fact, that we're putting out that information in competition with everything else that is vying for people's attention span, for their time, their money, their energy, et cetera. And that's a real challenge because people have to make choices about what they listen to and where they turn for information and all the rest. And there's everything that we've been looking at tells us we have much undermined opportunity space here to advance our ability to connect with people. So a couple of the other sort of tag phrases that fall under this that are important is letting public participation lead and engaging, building trust through participation. That is a very important point. Trust can be built, but it isn't built in abstraction. And if you look at Pew's research on, you know, the public's trust and faith in government, it is always highest with the government officials and the government representatives with whom they interact most directly. And that's a very powerful thing. There's a reason why local authorities, invisible local authorities, often end up rating the highest in government, among governmental authorities, in the public's trust. It's who people are interacting with more often. It's who they feel more connected with. And so what that tells us, in converse, is that the more opportunities for interaction and connection, the more opportunity there is to build context and build experience that's positive and try to strengthen those issues. So here's the second half of the San Diego suburb example. So to the credit of both the city, county, and the community, after having this experience with the fires, they made the necessary connections. And the following spring, when members of that community were lined up outside that same civic center for pro bono legal assistance during the foreclosure crisis, because that's where they were turning for help, they were also being talked to about what to do for safety during upcoming fire season. And so it's a marvelous illustration of figuring out how to communicate to people through the institutions and the mechanisms that they're already turning to and engaging with. So I'll give you one other example from Arizona, a mid-sized city in Arizona, about 260,000 people, that has had a lot of flash flooding issues. And at one point in time, I was speaking with the emergency manager in that city, and he was characterizing it as follows, saying there are about 900 points within the city that they had to erect some sort of protective barricades or other action to do with flash flooding. And it used to take the city on average about 3 days to erect all of those. So the problem with that is it's flash flooding. Flash flooding doesn't occur over, 3 days warning. And so he had that same observation, and his solution was to open the question to the community, publish their emergency operations plans, and open a dialogue with the members of that community and said, how do we deal with this? I talked to him about a year later, and by virtue of that interaction and changes that they'd made, he said the following. He said, first off, they got about 2,000 comments back from the public on their operations plan, which, by the way, is equal to or greater than the number of comments we tend to get back nationally on things like the major frameworks and other kinds of documents that we write up here. So that's an astonishing level of response from the public, first off. And his characterization was that he didn't know who put the barricade up or how they got erected. All he knew is the city dropped off the stuff, and it was up in hours, not days. And so the core point of that is he set conditions that allowed the public to be part of the solution in a meaningful fashion and to take ownership of that solution in a meaningful fashion. And the outcome was accomplishment of the task in hours, not days. And that's all a function of applying these principles to a very specific example challenge. So the third principle that we've identified here is the importance then of understanding where those points of strength already are and how to work to further strengthen them, to connect with them, to work through them, not to co-opt them, but to engage with them as a pathway and as an avenue. And so the two points that really apply here are the metaphor of a table, which I think is really powerful. Think about who's at our planning tables. Think about who controls the list of who's allowed to be at our planning tables. Think about who sets the agenda for our planning. And then think about the discussion that we had at the beginning under those simple truths about these being inherently social processes and social decision processes and the broader picture that we're discussing. And that should cause us to think differently about who's involved throughout every phase. So how do we create that space? We need to create that space, open up that opportunity. I often hear the lament that the public, isn't interested, is apathetic, or doesn't think this is their responsibility. I'll tell you anecdotally perhaps, but from my own experience and the past couple of years looking at this, I don't think that's the case in most situations. More often, I think the public doesn't understand how they gain access to the conversation, and we haven't done a good enough job of setting the conditions that allow for them to engage productively. Whether it's in the context of private sector organizations, faith-based organizations, nonprofits, et cetera. And so you see a lot of work over the past couple of years in our own agency trying to move in that direction. And if you take the time to flip through the doctrinal piece we put out, you see lots of stories and examples gathered from all across the country of how at a state level or at a local level, people are innovating in ways to do this. So the last point I'll give you to kind of wrap up the principles discussion and start the transition into the conversation here on the call is we need to think about this in the same way, think about the social context the same way we think about the physical context. We're used to thinking about critical infrastructure in the physical sense, in the systems sense. And what I'm submitting to you and what we really found through our dialogue is we need to think about the social infrastructure in that same way. We need to understand how that social infrastructure is organized. We need to understand its strengths. We need to nurture it and support it and work with it. And the more effectively we can do that, the better the outcomes that we will see in practice. And sometimes this can be emergent in the moment of crisis, and sometimes this is stuff that we can set up well in advance. And I'll give you an example, more or less of each. So first let me start with an event. I was really taken. I was in Joplin in September, and I was listening to the city manager talk about how they were organizing their thinking and setting their priorities in the very first hours and days after the tornado struck. And as you reflect back and look at what they did, they drew a very interesting lesson from some of the experiences that New Orleans experienced in Katrina, which was that they could lose large segments of their population. And that was, for them, as I heard it, a seminal sort of framing point as they thought about their recovery process. And the way I heard it articulated was, if our objective then was to retain our population, that meant we had to prioritize certain things, one of which was making the public a genuine part of the whole recovery process from the get-go. And so they organized a citizen advisory recovery team, which has undertaken phenomenal outreach and engagement to gather public voices and participate in the visioning process and the priority setting process in a very meaningful way. And I think that has been a phenomenal success story and an example of how to engage the public in the aftermath of the crisis. My apologies to everyone on the phone in case you can hear the train going by in the background. My office sits near a set of train tracks. I don't know what to tell you. The second example that I give you is something that is happening pre-incident, and that's in San Francisco. San Francisco has a huge advanced recovery effort, which is now part of their Resilient SF initiative. But part of that is thinking about how they mobilize engagement and connection with the social organizations that already exist in the city for everyday reasons. And so one of the things that they've done that I think makes this point nicely is create a neighborhood empowerment network, which is really seeking to connect and network the existing networks in different neighborhoods that are around different sets of issues. So this is absolutely about tapping into, connecting with, and strengthening the things that people are already engaged in on an everyday basis, but at the same time providing informational pathways and means of reaching out to and engaging the public in the aftermath, in the recovery right away following the earthquake. So all of this is really an articulation of a value proposition, and that value proposition is that a community-centric approach for emergency management that focuses on strengthening and adapting what works well in communities on a daily basis offers the best path to building societal security and resilience. It's about moving beyond sort of how government delivers solutions in crisis to how we set conditions to enable all aspects of society to deliver those solutions. And so you see referenced in the presidential direction the all-of-nation language, and it's exactly the same point. It's an acknowledgement that resilience isn't something accomplished through any one sector, but is something that is interwoven and interdependent. New Zealand has a wonderful phrase as part of their doctrine in this area, an acknowledgement that disaster resilience is inherently interdependent with resilience in other contexts, socially, environmentally, economically, culturally. And so strengthening our resilience to disasters is inherently a part of strengthening and interconnected with and dependent upon strengthening resilience in those other contexts. And so, again, that broader picture. So as we move forward as an agency, we're seeking to continue to advance this conversation. This webinar is part of that. And continue to talk about and gather insights and ideas from across the community of practice. We are also deliberately looking and applying these concepts to how we do business as an organization. And then the last point that I would make here is a part of Presidential Policy Directive 8 on national preparedness calls for a national campaign to build and sustain national preparedness and really move beyond awareness and seek to mobilize and motivate behavioral action. And so that is something that we're taking very seriously, and we are working right now to develop the core emphasis for and think about the approaches that we want to employ in taking on that issue. So there'll be a lot more to come as we look at this, but the general approach is one of how do we link together a large number of related activities in a manner that become mutually reinforcing and move us forward. I think for me, the overriding emphasis of the past 10 years has really been about how we break down silos within government, multidisciplinary, multi-jurisdictional, multi-level of government. And I really think that the next 10 years is about how we do that same thing, but now across sectors. How we create space and set up enabling frameworks that allow for meaningful, coordinated action among parties in government and out of government in this mission space, and to address these kinds of issues. So here's the link to the whole community doctrine. I would encourage all of you to give it a thumb through. I think it's an interesting read. I think it's a quick read, and something easy to do. And I'd also note for you that we are right now in the process of creating a discussion space on idea scale that has a specific emphasis around whole community and whole community in the context of how we achieve specific operational outcomes in catastrophic events. There are some very difficult challenges that we're struggling with. And we're trying to open the discussion to brainstorm around how we tackle some of those challenges. And so that, again, is the example of trying to walk our own talk. So with that, Amy, I'll turn it back to you and look forward to questions and discussion.
And suggestions too, right?
Absolutely, as many as we can take.
Very good. Okay, thank you very much, David. And now we will proceed to our discussion portion of the program. And to provide your input or ask a question, you just click on Q&A from the top menu, and then you'll type in the top half of the box that will open up. Then you click on Ask or hit Enter. Now, there is a hand-raising feature there, but we do not use that. When you click on Ask, your comment or question goes to an administrative panel that I will moderate. We basically take them in order, and I will announce who the question or comment is from and read it aloud, and then David will respond. And then I will type in a little text okay that releases the question to the bottom half of your panel. Please do keep your question or comment related to today's topic and reasonably concise. And the way live meeting works, you will only be able to submit one at a time. So we are ready to begin now, and you can enter your comment or question or suggestion at any time, and we are also interested in hearing about your efforts in your own community. And we do have a few on the line here. This one's okay. One moment. All right. Charles Sharp, one of our EIP partners, by the way, is with the Black Emergency Managers Association, and he says the whole community approach is a cornerstone of our association membership. In a system approach to whole community, we are an advocate of using reentry program of ex-offenders and juveniles by having a mixture of FEMA EMI and hands-on CERT training to returning back to the community with skills that can be used by the community in a major incident or disaster, specifically in the recovery phase. That sounds imaginative.
I think that's a great idea, and something that we should explore. I think that I've never thought about it in that way. I think that's a great example of where there's opportunity space. So I just wrote that down, Charles, and we'll be following up with you because I'd like to talk more about that.
Great. I'm going to ask a question here. Is whole community and whole activities and building specifically incorporated into the 2012 grant guidance, David?
Yes, it is. There's specific reference in the 12 grant guidance to advancing this. You also see it as mirrored. I neglected to mention the national strategy that was released earlier this year on empowering local communities to counter violent extremism, but that is also a guiding strategy for a lot of our prevention programs, and you see specific reference there, both in the national strategy and in our grant guidance, to actions that can be taken to support community engagement in these contexts. So across the whole mission space, prevention through to recovery, you see that as something that we're emphasizing.
Very good. And speaking of grants, and maybe this is a little bit off, it's somewhat on topic, Barry Lusby asked, why are the FEMA public-private partnership grants only available to states?
If they're the grants I'm thinking about, which are the nonprofit, they're largely around hardening or security measures at nonprofit facilities that might be at risk of attack. And so the construction of those program when it was created asked for a prioritization and a process to help prioritize which of those were most critical or most at risk and support and state involvement in that process, and thus ran those grants through the states as part of everything else. I would note that there are changes in some of those regards. In 12 a little bit with the way the grant programs are structured for this year, as well as other changes contemplated in FY13 to try to push us more and more to looking at how we build overall capacity as a nation in some of these areas.
Okay. Michael Lohr asks, and again, everybody, if I butcher your name, I apologize. How is FEMA working with other federal agencies, particularly HHS and CDC, to incorporate the whole community approach into state and local health and medical preparedness?
So I think that's a great question, and I would point out, and I was actually remiss for not mentioning the National Health Security Strategy, which equally strongly references and emphasizes resilience and engagement themes in that document. And that's one of the guiding documents between how HHS, to include CDC and other parts of HHS, are trying to advance work in the public health space. So there's actually a whole series of activities going on that side of the house that are very complementary and reinforcing of the concepts that we're pushing. So they're really echoing one another nicely. We obviously have coordinating mechanisms and such to sort of align emphasis and guidance, particularly in the context of our grants. So that activity is all going on. But on the ground, you should see a nice resonance between the things that are being emphasized in the context of public health and health security and the kinds of things that you're seeing us emphasize.
Not even going to try to pronounce Gil's last name here. He asks, where can one find best practices in community engagement? And I know you have some of them in this report. Any additional compilation of those where those would be available?
So I think that's a great question, and I'd actually like to turn that around. We've been talking about this for a little while now, and we think there would be value in a repository of that being created. We're just not entirely certain what the right way is to do that. That is allows for active population of those examples and use. And so I'd welcome people's ideas and feedback on that. either directly to me or, you know, through our think tank or our, you know, the whole community discussion on Idea Scale, any of those form are fine. We've obviously gathered a large number of those and put most of them in the publication that we sent out, but there are many, many more. And I think that it is a great idea to try to create a place where we can all go and see them and learn from them. And the question is, how do we do that in a way that is low burden for entry, both in terms of populating it with the examples and something that people will actually use? So I'd welcome thoughts and ideas in that regard.
And if I go back long enough, and Ava Dean, you correct my memory if I'm wrong on this, but I can remember when FEMA used to do at least an annual publication of community best practices, and even back then some of these were right on target, and it was an honor to be published. So, okay, question from John Nelderberg, who asks, how does this initiative correlate with PPD 8? You touched on it, but perhaps a little bit more.
So that's a great question. I would describe whole community as a core philosophy that's embedded within all the PPD 8 deliverables. So the language is slightly different. We're obviously using whole community as a language. If you go back and look at Presidential Policy Directive 8, the language used there is all of nation. But the core meaning is the same. And so this is very much how we are actioning that idea in that direction. And then when you go and review each of the deliverables that have been produced so far, the National Preparedness Goal, the National Preparedness System, you see woven throughout all of those the emphasis on broad view, broad approach, and inclusive, focused on meeting the true needs across the spectrum and engaging with and mobilizing capacities that exist in and out of government. So that emphasis on finding societal solutions, not governmental solutions, is at the heart of PPD 8. It's at the heart of the National Preparedness Goal, and it's obviously at the heart of whole community.
Here's a similar question. Daniel Hahn, how does the whole community concept fit in with the FEMA public-private partnership initiative? Is there collaboration, and I guess with the private sector office as well?
Absolutely. So what I would characterize there is, and Dan Stonking, who leads our private sector office, has been just going gangbusters in creating opportunities for us to engage in non-traditional ways with the private sector. So philosophically, it's the same thing. What Dan is doing is applying this philosophy in the context of how FEMA engages with the private sector and how FEMA supports broader engagement writ large. But that's everything from creating space within our Emergency Operations Center for private sector representation to the conference that we held last year, exploring a whole range of public-private issues in this space and all sorts of specific actions, you know, from operational coordination to co-branding on messaging and everything in between. So I would characterize it as actioning the concept in earnest through our private sector office for that part of the overall spectrum.
And we've got three more questions in the queue, and I think that's about all we're going to have time for today. You know, if we don't get to your question, certainly send them to us, and we can pass them on. Charles Sharp, he just wants to commend DHS. This is on the point of collaborating with the public health sector. I'd like to commend DHS and FEMA for the use of addressing the trauma communities encounter, trauma that communities encountered psychological, ensuring that psychological first aid was available in all the East Coast communities affected by the flooding. This took into consideration HHS and public health aspects of the community. And then I have a question for from Ava Jean. She says, David, thanks for bringing this information to us today. Are there plans to promote and publicize creative and successful whole community actions as they are implemented? Are you asking for notice of such actions across the country? And this relates to this compendium we were discussing earlier.
Yeah, I would love that notice, and would love that to create that kind of demand in the discussion. I will say that we have a program that we're not quite ready to launch, but I'll preview it. That we're working on a partnership arrangement right now for how to execute. But in the coming months, we plan to be announcing sort of an innovation challenge award, which would be administering in cooperation with outside parties, which would seek to create competition to both recognize and provide, you know, small scale financial support, the kind of micro level support for community based activities and that support these concepts and ideas. I'm sort of out in front because we're, as I said, we haven't finalized all the particulars in how to get there, and I think it'll be 4 or 5 months before we're ready to really talk about that. But we're looking for ways to be creative to try to incentivize, to try to catalyze and support and shine light of recognition on those leading edge practices. So if people have ideas, if people have examples, have stories, I would love to see them. You can email them to me directly, or you know, to the FEMA think tank, or to you know, the community engagement email that is up on our website as well. Any of those means are fine, but would love to hear about them.
And we'll take this last one from Emily Meyer. She's in with the Florida Post-Disaster Redevelopment Planning Initiative. She says, we were bouncing around ideas for how to encourage neighbor-to-neighbor efforts to redevelop entire communities block by block. Are there existing examples of really proactive marketing campaigns or programs that have connected survivors with a feeling of responsibility for long-term recovery outcomes?
So I think that's a great question, Emily. I'm not sure. The only thing I can think of off the top of my head that seems to really get to that is some of the engagement work that was going on in Joplin. I'm sure that's not, in fact, the only example. I will tell you, though, that we've been having a lot of discussions internally as well about neighbor-to-neighbor. One of the things we're finding is a lot of the sort of the preparedness messaging has been very successful in creating awareness, but much less successful comparatively in mobilizing behavioral action on the part of the public. And so we're questioning what other avenues we have and how do we get at that sort of neighbor-to-neighbor connection and motivation. You know, and I had an experience just this weekend, you know, of helping out a neighbor, which was completely second nature and didn't even think twice about, but offers an insight into doing things that are different from maybe what I would have done in my own home. And so there's some motivational power there that's worth exploring. I'd love just to know what you guys are bouncing around and maybe engage in some informal brainstorming around those ideas, because we're thinking about that too in the larger context of the campaign for national preparedness and how we encourage you know, action.
Again, that may be a matter of looking to other types of disciplines that are trying to do similar things, so, for example. Okay, I think we're going to have to wrap it up on that note. Let me put back up the slide with the web address. And David, on behalf of Ava Jean and myself and all our participants today, thank you very much for taking the time to share this information with us. And we'd also like to say a shout-out and thanks to your staff for assisting with preparation for today's program.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it. And my thanks to everyone for participating, for the great questions, and for the commitment to the issue. As I said at the onset, everything we've learned from all of you and your colleagues. And so this is really shared insight, and it's been a privilege to participate in it with you and to continue to do so. Thanks a lot.
And I'd like to stay in touch in terms of when the idea scale, do you have any time frame when you think that's going to be ready for the whole, on the whole community?
I think they're in the process of putting it up now. I can't remember if it's actually live or if it's going live in the next few days or a week, but it's imminent.
Excellent. Well, I'll look back for that, and if I find that in time, when we send out our follow-up announcements and or our transcript, we'll incorporate the link to that. But you will be able to access it from the same place that I mentioned at the beginning of the program, which is FEMA.ideascale.com. Okay, a few wrap-up announcements for our emforum.org newcomers today. Please note that we do have regular webinar programs on a wide range of emergency management-related topics twice a month, and they are normally held on the second and fourth Wednesdays of the month at noon Eastern. And then, of course, if you would like to get notices of those future programs, just go to our home page and subscribe to our mailing list. And then please do note, we do offer CEUs for attending our programs through a partnership with Jacksonville State University, and details on that are linked from our homepage. Thanks to everyone for participating. Have a great afternoon. We are adjourned.